Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thanks once again for joining me as we continue our look through the big old binder of classic vintage baseball cards. And believe it or not, we're almost done with the binder. It seems like yesterday we started it with that one Joe Coleman 1954 Topps card I have. Well, we're all the way up to 1978. The binder runs through 1980. And 78 Topps is one of those sets. I think it classifies as the you either love it or you don't. And the funny thing is, I know a lot of collectors who love it, not necessarily for the design or for some of the impact rookies or the star cards, but mostly because chances are you were maybe 13 or 14 years old around the time the 78 Topps set came out. Maybe a little younger. You might have been 7 or 8. But, you know, for me, I was an infant, so I've only collected it kind of, you know, in the past, just collecting lots and various stacks of cards at garage sales. But I know a lot of you who are listening, you were youngsters when this set came out, so you really love it because it connects with your childhood. And I know today's random pick from my stack of 78 Topps cards is going to connect with a lot of people. And that is card number 45, Mark Fidrick. Yes, the late Mark Fidrick, the Bird. So much to talk about with Mark Fidrick, not just his, I wouldn't say a career, because he did have a career, but it was unfortunately cut short due to injuries. But he had one magical season in 1976 that is still discussed to this day. And I love this card. It's card number 45, by the way. I love this card for a number of reasons, but the action shot is just great. This is pretty advanced for action photography in 1978 baseball cards. And also, it's the rare action shot of Mark Fidrick in 1978 because his injury started in 1977, and he was never, you know, over the next several years that he was still active in baseball, he was never the same as he was in 1976. But a lot of great stories and a lot of context around Fidrick and why he is still loved to this very day, even though he had that one season 41 years ago. There's a lot of Tigers fans and just baseball fans in general who still look back at him fondly because he represented a team that was looking to, you know, bounce back from some tough times, represented a city that was looking to bounce back from some tough times, but also really represented the buzz that a player could make back in the days before the internet and before cable television was nationwide. You know, right before ESPN went on the air, right before, you know, cable penetrated millions of homes, you know, probably about 10 years after he had that one season, he might have been the last player to create a buzz, to come out of nowhere, have a great season, and just set the baseball world on fire. And you know what? Major League Baseball needed it too. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes and take a look back at the 1978 Topps set as well. Before we get to what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains, just a quick reminder, we do have our listener survey out. We'll have it for maybe a couple more days. I think I'll close it out on Wednesday. So if you haven't taken part in that yet, please do. What we will do with our survey is this upcoming week, in lieu of a Flashback Friday edition, we'll do a special edition, probably like a 30-minute show, where I will basically go over the responses from the survey and let you know where the show is going to be going once we move on from the big old binder. Now, also be on the lookout for our wax pack auctions, or our vintage pack auctions, I should say. We had a fun one this past weekend. Wax Pack 916, our winner of the 79 Topps Cello Pack. And the Cello Pack got some action, not as much as I thought it would. So it's the weird catch-22 here. People want vintage packs, but vintage packs tend to cost a little more because they are a little harder to find. I did manage to get this one particular cello pack at a decent price, so we were able to make that happen. But Wax Pack 916 did purchase it. Unfortunately, no Ozzie Smith rookie card, but you do have the Steve Carlton card. So there you go. You got a Hall of Famer. That's probably, you know, without looking it up, that's probably a $3 or $4 card. So you get a couple dollars back there. But with any vintage pack, it's always fun to just rip it open and just see what's there, especially something as old as 79 Tops. You know, it's a 38-year-old cello pack. Most people don't have 38-year-old cello packs just lying around the house. So it's fun to open that up. And even though we didn't get the Ozzie Smith, it was nice to get the Steve Carlton card out there. Our next items up for bid this upcoming weekend, we've got three cello packs of 86 Fleer. Not quite the fanfare that you would get for something from 1979, but 86 Fleer, one of my favorite sets from the 1980s from Fleer. Very sharp, continued their business-like streak of cards that they released in the mid-80s. And you do have the Canseco rookie, which is still valued at several dollars. You've got Paul O'Neill, you've got Andres Galarraga, the late Darren Dalton, Cecil Fielder, and of course several of the 1980s stars, Cal Ripken, Ryan Sandberg, Wade Boggs, you name it. And with three cello packs, you're going to get yourself, I think, 78 cards. And of course, the wonderful Fleer stickers. So we will put those up there. Like I said, I definitely don't expect to command the dollar amount that we got for the 79 Tops cello or the 77 Tops wax pack we did a while back. But that's okay. You can get yourself a pretty good haul there this upcoming weekend. So again, we will tweet out that auction later on. Let's run through what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. And I say run through because we got a lot of responses to our question, which baseball card set was most representative of your childhood or connects most with your childhood? We hear from Ted Ziegler, who mentions the Toby Hara card, which was our random pull from our last podcast on 77 Tops, was one of his favorite cards from the set. Ted has a connection to the Washington Senators and Texas Rangers. His dad used to work for the club, and he mentions he not only liked the Toby Hara card from that set, but he also shows off his Mark Fidrick card from that set. And I know you're going to like this podcast because of our random pull being Mark Fidrick. Also commenting on the 77 set, Doug McCready, a new listener, says, listen to this for the first time. Great listen. And he sent me a DM about collecting the 77 top set. I won't get too detailed because it was a private conversation, but he did mention as a child, one of his biggest thrills was waiting to see if he could pull, you guessed it, a Mark Fidrick card from the collection. So I know you're going to like this show as well. And he says, a 1978 resonates with my childhood the most. So much anticipation for its release. And I'm assuming you're talking about the release of the 78 top set and not this podcast. But I do have hope that you're talking about both at the same time. For Russ Bear, and I'm just reading these as I got them in chronologically, so no real rhyme or reason to these. Russ Bear says, enjoyed 80s rundown and now the 70s. Slowly buying the sets of my lifetime. Just need 72 to 75. Sleep Frank likes the 87 Tops set. 1987 wood grain, first complete set we had. And he is related to the Boyer boys who played back in the 60s. And apparently they were a very, very big reason why he collected that one particular set. With the 89 Upper Deck response, we've got Marty O'Dwyer mentions 89 Upper Deck. I'm sure I'm not alone in that. You're absolutely right. We got several responses on that. And of course, if you are my age or, you know, Marty, I'm assuming you're around my age, 89 Upper Deck totally changed the game. Jeremy Conrad, a very interesting response here. 91 Donruss. Jeremy, I'd like to know a little more. Why does that connect with your childhood? That's not a bad thing. 91 Donruss is actually one of my favorites as well. It's not up there like 87 or 89 Tops, but a lot of good memories, and I'll tell you why. By 1991, I was pouring a lot of my disposable income into baseball cards, and 91 Donruss, that might have been the first box that I bought. Right after it came out, Series 1, 91 Donruss, if you look back at our archives, I called it the Tony set because, well, it looks like 1991. Or as one of our listeners, I believe Peter Steinberg, put it, looks like a Christmas sweater. And he's absolutely right. CompleteYourSets.com, 1982 and 84 tops. Jim W., 1972 tops. Robert McElwain, 77 tops. First year of the Jays, bad airbrush jobs and all. You're right, Robert. And as I've mentioned, 77 tops, one of my favorites because that's my birth year. I was a fan of the Blue Jays, and there's a lot of bad airbrushing, not just 77 tops Blue Jays. The Mariners had some really bad airbrushing jobs. And also speaking of bad airbrushings, Don Baylor's card, he was traded from Baltimore to California. He had a really bad airbrush. And by the way, the late Don Baylor, what a bummer of a week for deaths in baseball, losing Dutch Dalton and Don Baylor at the same time. Ryan says 78 tops. I played the game on the back of the cards. We'll discuss that in this podcast. He marked up many checklists and opened many packs before finally pulling a Rod Carew. That is a great picture, too, of Carew. I'm assuming he's going into the on-deck circle, or maybe he's getting out, but he's putting his rather scraped-up Minnesota Twins batting helmet over his hat. Robbie T. 86, 1981, moved back to U.S. that summer after 3 years overseas where cards weren't sold in the PX, so you were living overseas with the military. Here they were everywhere, and of course, 81, you didn't just have tops, you had Fleer and Donruss available. Mr. Sweet Matt Kimber says 82 tops, 8 years old, the magical year that Ricky stole 130 bags. And Harvey's Wallbangers Brew Crew captivated me. Yeah, Harvey Keene's Milwaukee Brewers that made it to the World Series. Only Brewers team to have done that in all those years. And even though 82 tops, again, you know, design-wise, not exactly my favorite, but that was your year for baseball. You got really sucked into baseball in 1982. Likewise, you know, like I said, 89 tops was that first pack that I bought. And it was kind of late in the 89 season. And even though I had watched baseball before and started understanding the teams and the players and the history of the game, after I started collecting cards in 89, when 1990 came around, I was all in on watching baseball. So I know the experience. Tim, 1974 tops at 8 years old, spent every extra quarter for wax packs wherever I could find them. Peter Steinberg, no-brainer, and I'm sure I'm not alone, 87 tops. After that, I think 1986 tops. Those were the years as serious pre-teen collector. And I think that's the key phrase there. A lot of us, you know, once you hit 14, 15, 16, and you start thinking about, you know, college, and you start thinking about getting your driver's license, and you start thinking about, you know, girls, and you start thinking about getting a part-time job to make some money, the disposable income still goes to baseball cards, but a little less as time went on. Russ Bear, one more thought from him. He said, 1979 tops baseball and football. All available funds of this seven-year-old went toward packs at the neighborhood grocery store. Speaking of football, Mick chimes in, 89 score football. I messed up and bought lots of 89 pro set for the same price as score. I did not choose wisely. And you know, it's funny, Mick. 89 pro set was the first football card that I bought. And I didn't buy as much as you. I unfortunately bought way too much 90 and 91 pro set, and those were one of the boxes of cards I was glad to dump in the great purge of several years ago. SD in the Ville Cards, thanking us for the shout out on the podcast, mentioned 76 tops was his favorite. Have nearly complete Dodgers team set in PSA 8 or 9. Good for you. 78 All-Star, 1978 Tops. Thought I recognized half of the guys in the set as fast pitch softball players my dad played against back in the day. That's one of the beauties of not just 78 Tops. 78 Tops is pretty good about this, but there are a lot of cards starting with 1975. And off the top of my head, I think of Daryl Thomas, who is with the San Diego Padres. I think of 76 Tops, the Roland Office card. And 78 Tops is quite a few. And I know there's a few in 77, but 78 really stuck out. There was a whole lot of disco stew going on in these sets. Man, there are some guys with the ultimate mutton chops, with the smoked aviator sunglasses. You know, there were guys who were Kent Tecolvay before there was Kent Tecolvay. And there's a whole lot of polyester and, you know, guys who, as they're getting their pictures taken, you know, especially in Shea Stadium or Yankee Stadium, going, man, I'm going to hit 54 after this game. Yeah, there's a whole lot of beer league softball looks going on here. Rick Canal, 1983 Tops. For the first time, I knew every player, and the profile showed who they were. Robert Lawson, one of my favorites of the 1970s, 1978. So I know you're going to look forward to this podcast. Also mentions he liked 72, 73, and 75. And finally, a thanks going out to Sparty Hawk Cachet, who has been spreading the word about our podcast through several tweets. Listened to our first Wax Ecstatic podcast yesterday during workout, discussed 77 Tops cards. Hashtag Rusty Kuntz. Got to get your Rusty Kuntz, man, and your Pete LeCocq. And Sparty Hawk spreading the word about several of our most recent podcasts throughout the 1970s. So thank you for doing that, Sparty. Make sure that you spread the word about Wax Ecstatic. Also, our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains for lots of discussion in our history of baseball cards here. You could talk about the podcast. You could talk about the sets, the players we discuss. Or you could just talk about cards you've received, cards you've liked as kids, things that you see now in the card hobby. You're more than welcome to. It's open 24/7, so just spew those thoughts out at Wax and Gum Stains. And a very quick reminder and a thank you to several of our listeners who have contributed. We do have two tip jars. We do not charge for this podcast. We easily could, and I bet most people would pay, 99 cents for a download or whatever, but we do have two tip jars because this is a free show. There are still some production costs that go into it, and there is a little bit of cost to this labor of love, mostly time and just recording and presenting this show to you every week. So if you would like to show your appreciation through cash, you can do so by sending us a donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Or if you're a Venmo fan, go to venmo.com/waxecstatic. Appreciate the donations we've gotten over the last few days. We're not asking for tens of thousands of dollars. It could just be tens, literally, $10, or a few dollars more, a few dollars less, whatever fits into your budget, whatever you think is appropriate for your consumption of the show. And that's all we ask, and we thank you again for your support. 1978. Tops, a favorite set of mine. And the reason why I like this set, even though, as I mentioned, I was just a toddler when the set initially came out, this was one of the first vintage sets that I was exposed to in large quantities. As I've discussed before, when I was a teenager, even though I was buying the new sets in 1989 and 90 and 91, very early on in my collecting career, I would go out not just to local card shops, but especially to garage sales and flea markets. Again, this is before the internet became what it is. And I didn't like doing it at card shops because, of course, the card shops were looking to make some maximum money. Well, at a flea market or a garage sale, most people were just looking to clear out a collection of cards that they had in their house. Well, with my limited income as a 13 or 14-year-old kid at the time, if I bought older cards, I would only buy maybe one or two from each year. And they were typically from the mid-60s to early 70s. Well, 78 Tops, I had a very interesting exposure to. It was one of those boxes of cards that I got through the Amway purchase. And I've told this story before about how pretty much every Christmas or every birthday for 2 or 3 years, I would find the Amway catalog. And my folks weren't Amway salespeople. Somebody that they knew were Amway salespeople, but they occasionally bought some, you know, cleaning products and other stuff from Amway. And Amway would have this for like, I don't know, $20. They had a 250 card collection, you know, the vintage baseball card collection. And it came in a 400 count box. And I don't remember if it was birthday or Christmas, but anyways, I get this card box in. I open it up. And with this being 1990, I'm guessing, yeah, there were a lot of 86 and 87 and 88 and 89 Topps, Donruss, and Fleer cards in here. But for whatever reason, whoever put together this box of cards put in, I want to say, maybe 10 or 12 78 Topps cards. And the card that I remember the most was the first one that I pulled. And I remember the most, not only because I was astonished that there was a 78 Topps card, you know, in 1990, this seemed like ancient history to me, but it was of Ron Pruitt, who was a catcher for the Cleveland Indians. And I remember the Ron Pruitt card so well, not only because it's the first 78 Topps card I got my hands on, but because Pruitt and the Indians in 1977, well, they wore those beet red uniforms, and they had the red tops and bottoms. One of my favorite Indians uniforms, by the way. And I just look at him like, wow, that's colorful. This guy looks like, you know, a giant zit in this red uniform. But I was just kind of amazed that they managed to, you know, put in a handful of these 78 cards amongst the usual pile of mid to late 80s cards that came in those boxes. So this was the first vintage set that I was introduced to at 10 or 12 cards at a time, as opposed to one or two when I went out and bought them. And I've always liked the design. It's a very simple design. And if you take a look at our random pull, again, card number 45, the Mark Fidrick card here, let's take a look at the front of the card. You've got a whole lot of border, white border, which I know drives some collectors crazy, but this is very minimalistic. This is very similar to, you could say, 74 or 76 tops, or even 70 tops. I wasn't a big fan of 70 tops, but once you get past the border, it's pretty simple. It's pretty clean. And in fact, this just looks like, again, a Polaroid picture. You know, we talked about the 77 top set producing cards that the fronts look like Polaroid pictures. Well, the front of the 78 tops looks very much the same. You've got the white border. You've got about 95% of the front devoted to a photograph. And I love this picture of Mark Fidrick in his delivery. And in the lower left-hand corner, you've got the team name kind of scribbled on, you know, almost like a Sharpie marker here. The team name would be represented in different colors, as would the inside border, the box that goes around the white border. You have the player's name in the lower right-hand corner. In the upper right-hand corner, you've got a baseball with a letter representing the player's position. And that was it. I've always liked this. It's clean. It's simple. It's got kind of this throwback 70s baseball kind of Sandlot feel to it. And from a design standpoint, I've always liked this. Now, I know some fans, and they'll go back to 1977. They'll say, well, 77 tops was pretty boring. 78 wasn't that good. Is there a wow factor to this card? No, not really. And that's what I think puts it into the category of you either like it or you don't. But with 78 tops, I found that if you like it, you really like it. And again, I think a lot of it is because a lot of collectors were, you know, anywhere from 7 to 8 years old into 17 or 18, you know, the sweet spot for collecting baseball cards. You were there in 1978. So, you know, this set resonates with your childhood. So if you like it, you really like it. If you don't like it, you really don't like it. And it's because it doesn't have that wow factor. It doesn't have that pop and sizzle. And because it followed 77, you're not real big on it. Now, even though I like 77 and 78 Tops, I will admit, after some of the great sets that Tops had churned out in the early 70s, and especially following 76 Tops, which I've made the argument could be the best set of the 70s, although 71 Tops will give it a run for its money, Tops entered a pretty down period. And, you know, if you want to go back and say it started in 77, that's fine. But in terms of creativity, yes, there was some simplicity to the card in 78, but you compare it to 76, it's not quite as wow. It's good, but it's not as catching to the eye. And that's hard to say when I look at this Fidrick card, because, again, I love the picture on here and the simplicity of the card. But Topps went through a very blah stretch, we'll say, from 78 to 82. Now, we'll discuss the rather complicated 79 Topps set in our next podcast. But they just did not have extremely exciting cards released at this time. And I had a listener actually ask me recently on Wax and Gum Stains, well, why do you think of that? Was it a money issue? I don't know. Yeah, and I'll try to get down to the bottom of it. One thing that has been brought up in our survey is people, and it's not a majority answer, but some people have suggested having guests on the show. And if I can make that happen, I will. And I would love to get somebody with some history in the Topps company on, and I have at least one person in mind, and there may be more, but I just think it's cyclical. You know, the Topps, if you go back to the mid-60s, Topps had some of their best sets, and I've highlighted 62 to 65 as being a glory era for Topps in terms of design, and then it really hit a lull in the late 60s. Came back around in 71. They had their stretch through 76 and then just kind of hit a lull again in the late 70s and early 80s. So I understand why some collectors aren't big on the 78 Topps set. It is part of a lull. Like I said, I think it's cyclical, but I really don't think that the 78 Topps set is a bad one. I am one of those people that likes the set and really likes the set. And it's also one of those vintage sets that I really enjoy because I happen to have a lot of it. And it all started with that, you know, 10 or 12 cards from 25 or so years ago in that box of randomly assorted cards from an Amway catalog. And I've been able to purchase up through various lots over the years. I probably have 300 or 400 of these cards. And I love looking through them. And it's not just because of the front. It's because of the back. There's something really unique about the backs of these cards, and we mentioned it when going through our listener comments on childhood resonating sets. Let's flip the card over. 78 Topps had a pretty unique back to it. We mentioned that green was the dominant color of the backs of 1970s Topps cards. They used it in 71, 74, 76, 77. Well, you don't see it here in 78. You'd see it come back with a vengeance in 79. But 1978 Topps had a rather unique mix of orange and blue. Even as an Alabama graduate, I can live with these Florida Gators or Auburn Tigers colors on the backs of these cards. But even though orange and blue you don't think of as a good color for the back of a baseball card, it really does work despite the gray cardstock from 78 Topps. So that makes the backs of the cards stand out rather easily. It's not green. You know, if it wasn't green, it stood out in the 70s on Topps cards. But also, as we mentioned, there was, if you look at the right-hand side of the card, a little game, and it's called Play Ball. If you look at the back of this Fidrick card, it says Play Ball, play by two, and you have a baseball diamond, and it says Fly Out underneath it. Now, I went through a stack of the cards I have just to verify, okay, how did you play this game? And they actually had some cards with the instructions on how to play ball. And you would take 50 cards, and your friend would take 50 cards, and you would basically just flip them one by one and play out a complete inning. And once you got to three outs, then you went to the bottom of the inning, and your friend would do the exact same thing. Now, I'm assuming you would, once you got to the bottom of the stack, you would shuffle the cards again. That way you're not getting the same cycle of action going on here. But that was a pretty neat thing to do with these cards, and it shows the innocence that was still in the hobby back then. In 1978, even though people started putting cards in plastic pages, even though people started setting aside those top star cards and those potential rookie stars that were coming out in these packs, even though it was very quickly shifting into, as soon as you open the pack, you set aside the valuable cards and the rest went in a box, there was still a childhood innocence in that you could also take 50 of these cards. Who cares about the condition? Who cares if it's a star? Who cares if it's a big rookie card? And we're just going to flip these things, and I'm going to beat you at a game of baseball. So I think it's a really neat connection between, you know, again, the innocence of card collecting in the 50s and 60s, where you didn't buy it for the cards, you bought it for the gum, you stuck the card in your bicycle spokes and you gnawed it up there, and what was to become a major industry, the hobby that would become a business, you know, especially officially starting in 1981 when you had competition for Topps. But, it was already starting to ramp up here. So I've always liked the play ball game. I've never played it, even though I probably could, because like I said, I do have several hundred of these cards. But I've always liked that on the back. It's kind of a neat thing on the backs of these cards. Now, also, once you get past play ball, you've got a pretty basic back here. Card number in the upper left-hand corner, player personal information along the top. You've got his complete career stats right in the middle. If room allowed, you had some interesting tidbit, which talks about one of his best performances in 1977, which, as you will discover, came right after his return to the big leagues after an injury in spring training, and right before he blew out his arm for good. In fact, 2 weeks to the day is when this particular performance is mentioned. And then at the bottom, you have the team name, the player name, and again, the position on the right-hand side. So the color combination, the play ball, it takes a rather ordinary back and makes it something special. So while I love the front of this Mark Fidrick card, it's one of the best action shots. And, there were a lot of pose shots in 78 Tops, but this one, the best action shots. Front, back, it all comes together really nicely, and I think it represents 1978, not just the sport, but the hobby as well, in a very good light. Now, 78 Tops is larger than 77 Tops, even though there was an expansion in 1977. Tops kept the set at 660 cards, while in 1978, they expanded the set itself to 726 cards. Some big rookie cards, the biggest one I would have to say is probably Eddie Murray, and that's mostly because he has his own card, even though you have Paul Molitor and also Alan Trammell in here. A couple other notable players, and they're all Detroit Tigers, by the way. Alan Trammell's magical infield magician, part of that duo Lou Whitaker, had his rookie card in 78 as well, as did quite the formidable battery of the 1980s, Jack Morris and Lance Parrish. So you've got some very, very big rookie cards there. The Murray card had the most value for the longest of times, but the Molitor card is certainly up there. And you have your usual subsets here. The rookie cards were featuring, and this is, you know, the Molitor and the Morris and the Parrish. They had the four pictures on one card, and they were designated by position, not teams. You also had playoff and World Series highlight cards, league leaders, and cards 1 through 7 were the record breaker cards. And that's something Topps would continue to do throughout the 1980s, in fact, into 1991, actually 92, I think they did the record breaker cards. So with kids still collecting cards as a hobby and not necessarily a business, a lot of those record breaker cards a little more valuable than some of the other cards, because a lot of those cards early in the set release held together by rubber bands or handled more because they were, you know, cards 1 through 7. If you put your cards together in numerical order, you had your grubby little hands on them a lot more. And there is a little more value to some of those cards because it's hard to find in mint condition. Speaking of hard to find in mint condition, you can even see with this Fidrick card more on the back than the front, centering once again a major issue for Topps at the time. Also, Topps had a little problem with some double printing back in 1978. So you had some cards just because of how the sheets were laid out. Some cards, there are plenty of them still floating around there, so that brings the grade down. Also, an interesting point here, and CardboardConnection.com brings this up, and I totally forgot about this, but Dale Murphy is featured as one of those rookie stars. Well, Murph actually had a rookie card in the 77 Topps set, believe it or not. So Dale Murphy is one of those guys who has has two rookie cards, technically speaking, but collectors will tell you the 77 Topps card is his true rookie card. The same thing happened to Lou Piniella. If I remember correctly, Lou Piniella had three rookie cards. He had one in, 64, 68, and 69, and with three different teams, too. And we should mention, too, Dale Murphy at the time was noted as a catcher. And that was his position. He was brought up as a catcher, signed by the Braves, brought up as a catcher. But his arm was too good. He would often, when throwing to second base, he would throw into center field over and over and over again. And finally, after a couple of years, the Braves said, you know what? If you're going to throw it into center field, let's put you into center field so you can get the ball back into the infield. And that turned out to be a pretty good career move for him. Now, 78 Topps is one of those late 70s sets that you can still find. As I mentioned, you can find lots of them at card shows. You can find them in local card shops, and you can get them pretty cheap. Again, as long as you're not too concerned about condition, you can get a stack of 78 Topps cards, including some star cards. You can get them for 20, 25 cents a piece in most cases. So you could, if you wanted to, you could get a stack of 100 cards for $20, somewhere around there. This is one of those sets where, unless it is a Murray or a Molitor card or even a Jack Morris card, the card dealer is not really going to make a mint off of 78 Topps cards. So if you're looking to just buy collections of cards to assemble your own, 78 Topps is pretty easy to get your hands on, again, if you're not too concerned about the condition. Now, 78 Topps is also one of those late 70s sets where there are plenty of wax packs still out there. You can get the occasional rack pack as well, but it will cost you. I've seen some 78 Topps packs. If you're lucky, you can get them for about $20, $25, but that's part of that 77, or rather 76 to 81 set of cards that for some reason has been priced very high recently. I've seen some packs going for $35 a piece. I've seen the wax pack trays, it's kind of a predecessor to the rack pack where they put three packs in a cardboard tray. I've seen those go for $100. I've seen the rack packs going for $100, $120. So the unopened 78 Topps starting to become a little harder to find in terms of affordability. You can still find unopened wax boxes of 78 Topps, but that will cost you several hundred, if not $1,000, depending on the seller. But it is still out there, and I would encourage you to get your hands on a bunch of these because it is a fun set. Like I said, it's got that gritty Sandlot feel to it, and it's very simple, and why not grab a handful of them, even if they're not in great condition or they're common cards, because you and a friend can relive those childhood days of playing play ball by flipping these cards on their backs. And maybe you'll end up with a Mark Fidrick. And Fidrick was such a key part to a Detroit Tigers team that was looking to rebuild in the 1970s. Of course, the Tigers winning the World Series in 1968, despite numerous race riots going on at the time. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But they win the World Series in 1968. Billy Martin able to bring the team up out of the ashes in 1972, gets them to the playoffs that year. They lose to Oakland in five games in the ALCS. But they didn't have a lot of talent in their pipeline. They had a lot of older players with that team. in 1972, and that eventually brought the Tigers down. They started hitting rock bottom in the mid-70s, and they had to start rebuilding. They were not a very good team for a very long time, and they start rebuilding with guys like Mark Fidrick, who grew up in Massachusetts in the Worcester area. He was selected in the 10th round of the 1974 amateur draft and starts making his way up through the Detroit minor league system. Well, while he was in the minors, a coach noted that Mark Fidrick had some rather frizzy hair. He had kind of the white guy afro, but not in a true afro. You know, it was just a mop top. It was a very common hairstyle in the mid-70s. And because Fidrick was tall, he was 6'3", and he was kind of skinny, too. With this mop top of hair, this coach in the minor leagues goes, "You look like Big Bird." And hence the nickname, The Bird, stuck around. So Mark Fidrick makes a fast track through the Detroit Tigers system and eventually gets his break. He gets called up to the team early in 1976, makes a couple of relief appearances, but then Joe Coleman, the son of the Joe Coleman that we featured in the 1954 Tops podcast. Well, Joe Coleman comes down with the flu, and the Tigers, who are led by Ralph Houk at the time, they just need a spot starter. So Fidrick, who was a starting pitcher, okay, he only has a couple of games of experience through relief. Well, he gets thrown into the fire on May 15th, a game at Tiger Stadium against the Sad Sack Cleveland Indians. And this was a harbinger of what the 76 season was going to be for Mark Fidrick. Now, again, the Indians were not a very good team, but he absolutely dominated, as he would give up just one run and two hits and one walk in a complete game. And in fact, he was no-hitting the Indians through six innings. So quite the way to start your career. And he certainly caught everybody's attention. Well, he continues to catch people's attention, not only with his dominance, as he went on this incredible tear over the next few months, and in fact went into the July 4th weekend with a win-loss record of 9-1. So it's not only what he's doing on the mound, but it's also what he's doing to the mound. Mark Fidrick was, let's just say, high-strung at the time. He was a character. So he would go to the mound and, you know, with his foot, he would kind of, draw little pictures in the mound. He would squat down, you know, on his hands and knees and manicure the mound. He would talk to the baseball. He would talk to the pitcher's rubber. He would just talk to nobody in particular out there. And he would also take the ball, you know, before he would wind up, and he would kind of hold it out there and just kind of, you know, do this kind of, you know, bizarre little mind meld, okay, ball, I'm going to throw you here and you're going to land there and we're going to get this guy out. He would look like a head case to anybody else. And it was actually quite infuriating for a lot of opposing team players. You know, they just want to hit the ball, and here's this guy who's talking to the ball and playing around with the dirt on the mound and, you know, doing all sorts of other weird things here. So again, it's 1976. This is before the internet. This is before cable television is everywhere. This is before your local regional sports network aired 150 of 162 games. This was back in the day where you only had two national TV broadcasts of games. You had the NBC Saturday Game of the Week and something new in 1976, Monday Night Baseball. Of course, on ABC, Rune Arledge, who had created Monday Night Football several years before, they decided to do the same thing with baseball. And this is where Mark Fidrick ends up in the spotlight. June 28th, Monday Night Baseball, Tiger Stadium. You know, because Fidrick had been doing so well over the previous few weeks, and because of his antics, started getting some press. People were buzzing about him. You were reading about him in the sporting news. Even Rolling Stone magazine did a story about him. All of a sudden, everyone's like, what's the deal with this Fidrick guy? Who is it? Where did he come from? He's a kid. He's this lanky kid who's not only just dominating on the mound, but he's talking to baseballs and he's marching around the mound. He's getting on his hands and knees and rubbing dirt off the pitcher's rubber. What's with this guy? So a huge crowd tunes into that game, even though the Tigers were not a very good team. They're actually three games under 500. It's the Tigers and the Yankees, and the Yankees are now on the upswing. They would go on to win the American League pennant. They would get swept by Cincinnati in the World Series. But here you have this young and exciting Yankee team coming into Tiger Stadium. You have this ho-hum Tigers team, but this incredible talent and oddball in Fedrick pitching. So you have a sellout crowd. You have more than 50,000 people. In fact, if I recall correctly, Fedrick accounted for, in home games that he pitched, he accounted for, I think, a third of the attendance at Tiger Stadium that year. And the Tigers didn't draw well only when Fedrick was pitching. So he goes out and he just dazzles again. Goes the complete nine, wins a 5-1 game in 1 hour and 51 minutes. Can you imagine an American League game today lasting an hour and 51 minutes? You think it would have been rain shortened. It would have been five innings, especially if Joe Girardi's out there with his September call-ups. But, I mean, this guy was not only animated, he was not only good at what he did, but he was efficient. And you can see that in pitchers who are efficient. They just go out there and just pound the ball in there and do their thing. It kind of ignites the rest of the team. There's energy around a pitcher who is just going out there and taking care of business and not just lollygagging and looking at the baseballs. Oh, this one's a little too scuffed. Let me throw it back. Although it should be mentioned that Fedrick would eventually throw baseballs back to the umpire because he felt that there were still hits in them. So, you know, he had these rather unique things going on here. Well, he was not only part of the All-Star team in 1976, he started the game in Philadelphia that year. The American League would lose, as they often did in the All-Star game back then. And he would go on to just absolutely dominate that season. As he finished the season with a 19-9 record, a 2.34 earned run average, 24 complete games. Again, that's a number you're never going to see in this day and age of baseball. And even though he was not known as a dominant strikeout artist, he still had a 2-1 strikeout to walk ratio. Was not only an all-star, he was obviously a rookie of the year for 1976. He was the runner-up in the Cy Young Award voting that year, which that award would be won by Jim Palmer, who had a phenomenal season. And he was even in the MVP voting, albeit a slightly distant 11th place. So even though the Tigers were sub 500, even though they were still a long, 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 long way at being competitive, Mark Fedrick gave Tigers fans something to be excited about. And of course, there's the obvious answer. Well, Matt, he had a pretty good year. Yes. You know, whenever you have a rookie, and especially a pitcher, whenever you have a rookie pitcher that just has this phenomenal season, everyone's going to start talking about him. So, yeah, even though Fedrick's career was very short and it was basically one solid rookie season that people remember him for, yes, that is one reason why he made such an impact. But there were a couple of other reasons. One is what was going on in the city of Detroit in 1976. Now, the city of Detroit, of course, loves their Tigers. And as I mentioned before, the Tigers were heading on their way down when they got them. It would be several years before they became contenders and, in fact, world champions in 1984. But at the very least, you have this one glimmering piece of hope for the future for Tigers fans. So that's another reason why the Tigers fans absolutely loved him in 76, because the team was not good, but he was, and at least you had something to rally around every fifth day when Fedrick took the mound. Now, another thing, though, is more of the social impact. We all know about Detroit's problems nowadays, and they have been really magnified in the last 10 years with the economic recession, the filing for bankruptcy a few years ago. Everyone is quite aware of Detroit's plight. But a lot of Detroit's problems started well over 50 years ago. In fact, you could go back to the mid-60s as you had the auto industry was starting to buckle just a little bit. You know, they were making these ginormous tank size steel alloy vehicles that were popular in the early to mid-60s, but you started getting inroads from foreign competition. And that really snowballed in the 1970s, where you had the energy crisis, the big clunky old cars were not as desirable, not just because of performance, but of course for fuel economy. So people started looking at Japanese imports. You had Toyota and Datsun, Honda would eventually come along. And then the German import craze started in the 70s, would really materialize in the 80s, though. People wanted to buy Mercedes and BMWs, and they also started checking out Porsche, and the Volkswagen brand had been around for a while. The trusty Beetle had made inroads in the mid-60s. So the auto industry collapses, but also the race riots of 1967 really was the first big domino to fall and cause a lot of the troubles that you see in Detroit nowadays. So the race riots in 67 happen that expedites the white flight to the suburbs, but also the African-American population that was in the heart of downtown Detroit. It was a pretty sizable number of people who lived there, but the race riots actually destroyed not just the white businesses, but also the black businesses as well. Nobody was able to step into the vacuum and kind of pick up the pieces and rebuild Detroit. So you not only have the white flight, but then the people who are left behind in Detroit really don't have the tools necessary to rebuild the city after the 67 riots. So you start having this decay in the heart of Detroit with the riots in 67. It continues throughout the next several years. And in the mid-70s, you have corrupt politicians, you have some harebrained schemes as to how to rebuild the city. And you could see the pieces coming apart. You can just see it all falling apart by the mid-70s. So by 1976, if you're a resident of Detroit or the immediate area, and you're seeing what's going on with race riots and race relations, with the economy tanking, the big three automakers taking it in the gut, and then, you know, this politician's just royally screwing everything up for various number of reasons, some say for racial reasons, others because they were just incompetent or corrupt. You know, there are quite a few that had some prison time shortly thereafter. I mean, things are just not going real well, to put it nicely, in 1976. So you have this gleaming source of light, not just for Tigers fans, but just for residents of Detroit and greater Michigan, really, in the form of Mark Fidrick. You know, this was a guy who gave them a reason to have some hope and to be entertained and not worry about all the nonsense that was going on. So that was a big reason for his success, but also on a greater scale for Major League Baseball. Gone were the days of the heroic auras that were thrust upon guys like Mickey Mantle and Ted Williams and Willie Mays and Jackie Robinson. You know, baseball players weren't just baseball players. They were heroes. They were gods. Well, that changed as society changed. And it really started changing in the mid to late 60s. You know, as you had more and more rebellious young adults entering into, you know, the world population, you also had more young adults who were rebellious ball players. And you can trace a lot of it back to, for example, Jim Boughton's book, Ball Four, which was released in 1970. But there were players well before Jim Boughton who were of the rebel variety. You know, Pete Rose is a guy that I can think of. You also had Curt Flood, who was dealing with the reserve clause and all of his issues with the St. Louis Cardinals at the time in the late 60s. But also the bad boys were kind of standing out. You know, like I said, Pete Rose was a bad boy. You know, Charlie Hustle. You had the swinging A's with their facial hair, which was something you didn't see that often in baseball prior to the early 70s. Dick Allen, you know, was revered not only because of his ball playing style, but because he was such a rebel. And then you had guys like Reggie Jackson, who were immensely talented, but could be, to put it simply, gruff along the way. So, you know, Mark Fidrick was a little rebellious, but a lot of quirky and unique. And again, before the days of internet and cable television and regional sports networks, it was a sight to behold when you found a player like this. And I think back to just a few years ago, Bryce Harper, you know, when he's, what was he, 21, 22 years old, he comes out, he's just taken the National League by storm, but he's also got an attitude, you know, the whole, you know, that's a clown question, bro, you know, that type of thing that I did a few years ago. Well, now, you know, you just take your phone out of your pocket and you look up Bryce Harper and you see his highlights and all that other stuff. But in 1976, you couldn't do that. And you only had two televised games nationally where you could see this stuff. So the only way to see a character like Mark Fidrick was to either see that one of two games broadcast nationally on ABC or NBC, or you had to go to the ballpark. So, you know, Tiger Stadium was the place to be when Fidrick pitched, but it should also be noted, wherever Fidrick was on the road, that home team would cash in big time at the box office because people just wanted to see, what's this kid all about? Not only is he an outstanding pitcher, but he's a goofball. So people wanted to see that. And now it's easy to see it from the comfort of your own living room or even, you know, the driver's seat of your car. If you're at a red light, you pull out your phone, you can watch a highlight. But back in 1976, you had to see it. Mark Fidrick became a traveling circus. He was very, very talented, but because he was just such an oddball in so many other ways, he became something that you had to be there to see, to really experience the bird. And like I mentioned, he also had an article in Rolling Stone. He was one of only a handful of athletes in the history of Rolling Stone. That magazine's been around for 50 years. One of a handful of athletes in the history of the magazine to appear on the cover. So, you know, he really caught the attention of a lot of people, not just sports publications. Now, unfortunately, the downfall would happen for Fidrick in spring training of 77. He's out shagging fly balls, tweaks his knee, starts the season about a month in. So he starts in May, and there's some conversation on maybe the knee injury wasn't completely healed. Maybe he altered his pitching style to compensate for the knee injury. But one way or another, despite having a pretty successful 11 games of experience early in the season, on July 4th, in a game against Baltimore, as Fidrick would say, his arm just went dead. It just popped, and that was it. He just couldn't throw anymore. Well, he had torn his rotator cuff. The only thing is, he didn't know he had torn his rotator cuff. Now, before the Tigers were owned by some well-financed owners in the late 70s, the team skimped a little bit on money in the mid-70s. So it's hard to say that he had the right people and the right tools to diagnose his injury. They just figured, well, it's just a dead arm. He just needs a little bit of rest. That was not the case. Turned out to be a torn rotator cuff. Nowadays, you get the Tommy John surgery, you're back in action, what is it, 12 to 16 months, something like that. But, you know, had he been properly diagnosed and taken care of, we could be talking about a completely different Mark Fidrick story. But that was not the case. He was an all-star in 1977, but because he had blown out his arm just days before the game, he didn't participate in the game at Yankee Stadium. He had only a handful of appearances in 78, 79, and 1980, and that's when his career would end. In 1980, at the age of 25, he would complete his major league career with a 29-19 record, a 3.10 earned run average, and 170 strikeouts to 99 walks. And that's pretty much it. He did have a brief flirtation with the Boston Red Sox. He did sign with the Red Sox after he was released by the Tigers in 1981. But he was released by the Red Sox during the 82 season, never played for them. And that was unfortunate because, of course, being a Massachusetts native, I'm sure he would have loved to have been able to pitch for the Red Sox. Now, despite his flash-in-the-pan success, and again, a lot of it was just due to injury that he wasn't able to build off that success, he actually, by all accounts, had a pretty good life and a pretty good attitude about it. Sure, he would have loved to have had a greater impact in baseball, a longer career. He would have liked to have made more money, but he did cash in at the time with his opportunities, not only doing magazine covers and appearing on TV shows and stuff like that, but he also was able to sign, at the time, a relatively lucrative contract that he was able to cash in, at least for a short time. Also, he was a thrifty guy to begin with. He wasn't throwing money around all over the place. So it sounds like even through the limited action that he saw after the 76 season, he was able to make a pretty decent living for himself. He went back to Massachusetts, became a truck driver and a contractor, and just kind of lived the lunch pail life. I mean, he was just your average Joe. And he would occasionally appear like on MLB Network or ESPN Classic whenever they played back that 1976 Monday Night Baseball game against the Yankees. He would often appear, for a studio show that would be either before or after the game was replayed, or they would interject some Q&A with him during commercial breaks. So he had a pretty good attitude about it. Unfortunately, he died a very tragic death on April 13th, 2009, in his home in Northborough, Massachusetts. He was apparently working on one of his trucks, and this is a heavy-duty truck. You know, this isn't just like a Ford Ranger. This is one of those, tractor-trailer trucks. And he's working underneath it, and nobody's really sure what happened because he was found by a friend dead. But it appears that he was working on a truck and his clothing got caught up with one of the shafts that comes out of the engine compartment and runs, the wheels. So basically his clothing got caught and he got strangled to death, which is just extremely, extremely disturbing when you think about it. But he passed away far, far, far too young at just the age of 54 years old. But Mark Fidrick had, like I said, despite the 1 year of success that most people would hang on, he had a good attitude about it. Loved talking about that magical 76 season. Loved talking about that one game during the 76 season in June of 76, where he was featured on a Monday Night Baseball. And for many, many years was, in the palm of the hands of Detroit Tigers fans, despite the fact that he wasn't part of that World Series team in 84, didn't have a very long career there. He was that one source of light and hope, not only for Tigers fans, but for the city of Detroit, for the state of Michigan, for much of middle America during a very turbulent 1970s, not just in economic stances, but also with, race relations and population shifts and just business shifts. America changed a lot in the 1970s, and Fidrick was the one guy out there who was having fun. And even though he was quirky, people wanted to see it. It was a pleasant distraction from all the other nonsense in the world. And Fidrick was able to provide that. So quite the story of Mark Fidrick, gone far too young. But he had that one glorious season in 1976 that baseball fans still talk about to this day. And baseball card collectors still talk about because of his short career, he only had several cards released during that time span. And this is one of them. Again, a favorite photo of mine and one of the interesting players. Certainly not like a Hall of Fame type guy, but a guy that represented the sport and a city and a state when they really needed something positive and different and energetic. And Mark Fidrick brought all of that in 1976. And he brings it to this 1978 Topps card, card number 45. All right, coming up on Friday, we will do our survey show. We'll take a look at your survey answers, let you know what direction the Wax Ecstatic podcast will be going in just a few weeks once we get through the big old binder. Only two more sets to look at, and we'll look at the next set next Tuesday with our latest episode, 1979 Tops. This is a set that's got some good things to it, but a lot of people don't like it for various reasons, and I'm not a huge fan of it either. We'll take a look at the 79 Tops set next week. Our new show will come out on Tuesday at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern Time. And look for our programs, not just new programs, but archive programs as well, on Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and TuneIn. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for joining us for another edition of Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next week.